Today is March 5th, 2010. I'm Brad Pepink, and you're listening to News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepink was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us on this Friday evening. Today on the show, we have Groundwire, the National Campus and Community Radio Association production, which today features youth from Flemco City Media Project, CFPK, in Toronto's Flemington Park. As always, this week's edition of Groundwire features stories from across the country, and today focuses on anti-apartheid movements, women in prison, and tuition hikes in Alberta. Also on News 101, we'll be looking into ballot irregularities in the AMS election. We'll be answering what it means for UBC students. But first, the Olympics are over and many are crying about overspending and deficit-inducing two-week parties. We'll have a look at the provincial budget right here on News 101. To start things off, Andrew Longhurst is in studio to speak with NDP MLA for Vancouver West End, Spencer Herbert, who will speak with us about the provincial budget. Andrew?
Thank you, Brad. And on the line, we have Spencer Herbert, the MLA, BC NDP MLA for Vancouver West End. Thanks for being with us, Spencer.
Glad to be here.
And so the BC Liberal government just unveiled the 2010-2011 budget this week. Were there any surprises in this budget for you?
Well, I wish there were. I guess the thing is it's pretty consistent with what this government does and has been doing for the previous 8 years. We see cuts to programs that matter to the average person and tax breaks for the very few who, you know, are already doing very well. I guess the only surprise is how much harder it will be for the average person if this budget goes ahead as it currently stands. Of course, I speak of huge cost increases like the HST hikes in BC Hydro, hikes in quite likely hikes in tuition, MSP, kind of the list goes on, and then cuts to the things that we hold dear, you know, our environmental protections, arts and culture. We're seeing cuts in advanced ed, student aid. The list kind of goes on and on. Programs that support our most vulnerable when we already, for the, I guess it's the seventh year, have the worst child poverty rate in Canada, so pretty disappointing.
I want to start with talking about arts funding, because you are the critic for tourism, culture, and the arts. There's been an $8 million increase in gaming grants, which brings the total funding for the gaming grant funding available to community organizations and arts groups to $112 million. Do you believe this is adequate?
The $8 million is only an increase based on the budget from September. The pre-election budget actually had a much higher amount of money. This is money that comes from gambling in communities going back to charities, which is, of course, the agreement and something that's been used to expand gambling. People said, well, there'll be more money for charities, so you should allow a casino in your community. What the Liberals did after the election, of course, was take $77 million out of the gaming revenue from communities and put that back in into their own general revenue. So to add $8 million back when you took $77 million is not really all that all that much. For arts groups, in fact, we've actually seen a decrease. It used to be about $20 million from gaming went to arts and culture. This year, it's about $11 million. This in a sector that actually is good for the economy, the creative sector, good for jobs, and really, it's about telling our stories and getting to know each other. So I think arts and culture is vitally important for our province, and we saw that over the last year with protests, rallies, petitions, and the Union of BC Municipalities, which is all the cities and town councils in BC, voted unanimously to call for government to reinvest in arts and not cut as they've been doing. But unfortunately, that wasn't accepted by the government.
The Minister of Finance, Colin Hanson, did unveil a new 2010 Sports and Arts Legacy Fund, which will give $30 million for community sports and athlete development and $30 million for the arts and cultural organizations. Do you see this as good news? I mean, does this make up for the lost gaming funding that has that arts and cultural groups have, some of them are not seeing anymore?
Well, it's interesting. It's what you've just said there, the $30 million for arts, $30 million for sports. It's actually $10 million for arts, $10 million for sports, spread over, you know, so $30 million spread over 3 years. But that kind of is part of the spin job that's been going on in this budget, where they'll cite a figure, make it look quite large, but when you actually break it out, it's not what it seems. It doesn't replace at all the funding they've taken. The BC Arts Council, for example, is getting cut 50%. This is supposed to be the lead agency for arts and culture in BC. It's getting a 50% cut. And so overall, they're taking with one hand way more, and then they're giving something back like this with this Arts and Sports Legacy Fund, which nobody that I know in the arts and culture community has been calling for. They've been calling for steady funding, reinvestment in the arts, and they have no idea actually how this funding may be spent, if it's even going to, you know, how much is actually going to get down to arts and culture organizations, because the government itself doesn't know how the money's going to be spent.
Well, and this comes after we saw a number of musicians and artists on display and showing off their fine work during the Cultural Olympiad.
Well, absolutely. We saw incredible work, and we're still seeing incredible work as the Cultural Olympiad continues.
Do you think voters are aware, to the degree that you speak of, that these cuts are occurring and how they will be impacting the arts and culture community?
I think so, to a large extent, actually, in a way that hasn't been seen in BC for many years. You know, when was the last time arts and culture was on the front page or led a newscast on the television? Lately, that's been happening because people have been speaking out. People have been arguing for arts and culture investment because we've started to see the impact of these kinds of decisions with, you know, for example, over on Vancouver Island, their longstanding children's festival is now gone completely. Companies here in Vancouver, art galleries closing, you know, and we're losing artists to other jurisdictions. So our creative folks who we've assisted in the past as government are now leaving the province just because we are the lowest investor in arts in BC, in Canada.
Was the Cultural Olympiad, do you see it as sort of the last hurrah before we see arts and culture?
Well, that's the big worry in the arts community, as they said. Is this just a show for the world to make it look like our province cared about arts and culture, only to see after the public eye leaves, the axe come out? And in a sense, that's what's happened. Britain, London, they had a huge concern, and actually we got calls from the BBC and from people in London saying, well, we have the Olympics coming to London. Are we going to see huge cuts to arts and culture like British Columbia is seeing because of this? You know, and it's not necessarily a causal relationship, but it is concerning all the same.
Now, I realize you aren't the education critic, but I want to talk a bit about post-secondary funding and what we have seen in this new budget. There have been virtually no increases in post-secondary operating grants.
That's right.
Can you comment on that?
Yeah, it's a troubling thing. Yeah, you freeze funding, basically, yet a freeze in funding, well, you go, oh, okay, well, we won't give any more over this time. That's fine. We'll just hold everything the same. But the thing is costs don't stay the same. You know, you see increases in hydro, for example, increases in MSP, which will have to be paid for the staff. There's all sorts of other costs that are added on, which aren't accounted for. So, in fact, their expenses go up, so they're going to have to find some place to cut or raise more revenue. And, of course, with the BC Liberals, we've seen the place they go to raise revenue is students. Students having to pay more in tuition year after year. And early on, they claimed, okay, well, if we're going to do this, we're also going to increase student aid to help students who can't afford it. But this year, we've seen student aid cut by about 23% on top of the cuts they made in the summer. So it's becoming more and more difficult to be a student in BC, and the debt loads are getting higher and higher. This goes completely contrary to where we need to be going, because with an aging population, we need to ensure that the people that are younger are better equipped to deal in today's economy. And that's education. That's training. Yet we're going in the absolute reverse. So, and that's the same in the elementary and secondary education as well, with overcrowded classrooms and that kind of thing. So instead of, you know, the budget speaks about the challenge, yet it does nothing to address the challenge, and that's very concerning.
Although there have been some critics to, the BC Liberals would say, though, on the other hand, they've restored facility grants
for
secondary and elementary schools. Mm-hmm. You know, they would argue that there has been funding that has been restored, and maybe people should just realize that and realize that there is funding being made available.
Yeah, and that is the argument that the BC Liberals make, but I guess where I come back to is there's a real credibility problem with this government. You know, we've got to remember this is the government that promised pre-election that they wouldn't do the HST. They wouldn't raise taxes in that way because they said it was bad for consumers. And it was not a good thing to do. Then, right after the election, they say, oh, actually, we're going to do the HST. So it's very difficult to believe them. They also are the ones that said that the provincial debt would be, I think it was $495 million maximum, Gordon Campbell said. Yet here, this year is 1.7, last year 2.8 billion. So there's a real credibility problem. And on the facilities grants for secondary and elementary schools, again, they say we're going to restore this funding to the same level it was at before. But again, this is another sleight of hand, another kind of forked tongue moment, where actually what it is they're only giving half the money back this year and then half in the next. So yes, when you add it up, it looks like it's a restoration, but it's actually half of what they did before. This is kind of consistent with this government's approach, where basically every election, right after the election happens, they do a massive cutting program where they cut all sorts of public services, they lower the public's expectation, and then right when we're getting closer to the next election, they give back a bit of those programs. So people think, oh, okay, so they're giving this back, it was just a temporary thing. Yet generally we've seen those programs that have been given back have been less than what it was that they cut before.
I want to talk a little bit about the increases to specific ministries.
Sure.
The Ministry of Community and Rural Development saw its budget doubled, and that may have been one of the only few to see such an increase. Why specifically an increase to that ministry when other areas are being cut?
Well, what we saw was about $47 million of that increase was from the federal government. So that helps. You know, obviously when a different government gives you money and says you have to spend it here, that helps you increase that budget. I know $58 million of that is only one-time funding. And then there's about $32 million as well, which is taken, moved from ministry to ministry. It's another interesting trick that they've got where every budget you find that a program that was held in one ministry may have been moved into another, because that may disguise something, so it looks like a budget has grown. In fact, when what has happened is we've moved a program which used to be in a different ministry over. So on the surface, until you actually get down into to digging through the minute details, it may look good, but it's actually the same budget as was there before.
We'll be seeing about 1,200 full-time provincial jobs eliminated next year. How is this likely to affect the provincial government and the effectiveness of our provincial government in
Victoria?
Yeah,
it's very interesting. We're seeing in the environment ministry, it's quite large cuts, and those are some of those jobs you referred to. So we're seeing, for example, environmental stewardship in our province cut by about 20%, water stewardship cut by 20%, compliance with environmental regulations cut by about 20%. So it's the problem that we've got, of course, now is that you can have the best rules in the world, but if you don't have anybody to enforce them or to actually make sure that parks or protected areas are actually being protected, it's no good, or that industrial polluters are actually following the proper codes, those rules aren't worth anything. So it's we're seeing further losses in those areas. We may see further losses in the parks as well, park staff. Forestry is taking a big whacking, and that is very concerning. I know a number of environmental organizations have spoken out quite strongly against that, because they say, the forestry industry is suffering right now, but if we ever want a sustainable forestry industry in the future, we need to be making sure that we're actually replanting the trees that need to be replanted when we log. Right now, in BC, we're only replanting about 3/4 of what gets logged, which leaves quite a deficit in that area.
Obviously, no one wants to see cuts to programs, but I guess the argument would be that if we don't make some of these cuts and we don't slim things down a bit, we will be running deficits into the next decade or even beyond.
Sure. Yeah, and I guess the challenge with when we only think about the financial deficit, we don't think about social deficits, we don't think about environmental deficits. For example, we know that if we invest in our children and they get a strong education, a strong start in life, they're going to be more productive members later on in life, and there's going to be lower costs in crime, lower costs in health care, a whole range of lower costs that would have to be dealt with. That's not dealt with in a traditional fiscal framework. And unfortunately, with the way the politics sometimes work, we think in such short term that we end up costing ourselves more in the long term. But you're right, we've got to trim where we can, but we've got to be smart in how we do it. Looking at strong economies elsewhere in the world, they also understand that in the way the economic that we work under works, there are downturns, and that's when you stimulate the economy to get out. And then when you're in good times, when you don't have deficits, when, all the cylinders are firing or whatever the metaphor might be, that's when you use the surpluses to pay down your deficit. We saw that to a certain extent with this government, but I think unfortunately what we got is in the last 8 years, we seem to have this belief that the good times would roll on forever. And then when the recession hit, it was a government unprepared to deal with it, and that's why they're making these drastic maneuvers.
Okay. Well, Spencer, I think we'll leave it at that. Again, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Much appreciated.
And great to talk with you.
Thanks, and to your listeners, please write your MLAs, give them a phone call, get in touch. It's the best way for them to know what you want to see in government.
Great. Well, thanks again, Spencer.
Have a good one.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was Spencer Herbert, MLA for Vancouver West End. He's a BC NDP MLA.
Thanks to Andrew for that interview. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll hear from Isabel Ferreras of AMS Elections about an incident involving vast voting irregularities. That's all here on News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Want to know how to choose the right courses for your program? Want to learn more about majors, minors, honors, and professional programs? Are you looking for information about co-op, exchange, or careers? This is how we do it. The Imagine Your Arts Major Fair is a one-stop shop where professors, advisors, student leaders, and staff from over 60 programs within arts are brought together in one place so that you, the student, may connect with different departments. Imagine Your Arts Major, March 17th at the Student Union Building Ballroom from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. In addition, there will be workshops between March 8th and 12th offered by Arts Advising, Arts Co-op, Career Services, and Go Global. For more information, visit our website at www.arts.ubc.ca/students/IYAM. Imagine Your Arts Major, March 17th at the Student Union Building Ballroom from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Industrial noise and goth. Tune into the Vampire's Ball. Midnight, 4 a.m. Friday nights, right here on 101.9 CITR FM in Vancouver, www.citr.ca.
Listen to them and go, this is really cool stuff. And people want to make music like this, and they never have, and they never will. This is really cool stuff, and people don't make music like this, and they never have, and they never will.
Probably the closest to my heart.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. As a prelude to our Olympics coverage, we offered an in-depth look into the AMS elections. Now that the AMS has hired an independent consultant to look into tremendous voting irregularities, Andrew Longhurst spoke to AMS Elections' Isabel Ferreras. Here's that conversation.
This is Andrew Longhurst. I'm here with Isabel Ferreras, the AMS Elections Administrator. And Isabel, can you tell us about the voting irregularities, what you know at this point, and how this will affect the outcome of the recent AMS election?
Well, what I can tell you is that we discovered over the reading break that there were 731 fraudulent votes in our system. The way we discovered this is that they all came from the same IP address in 15-second increments, starting at about 12:45 till 4 p.m., the voting deadline on the last day of voting, which was January 29th. Some of these votes were unanimous for certain categories. I can't disclose which ones they are, and some were randomized. So, as you can see, there's every instance of fraud is right there, and there's lots of other reasons why we can say that they are. I can't say what races they've affected so far. I can say that there's a probability that they've affected the voter fund media, the referendum, and the Senate seats primarily, but that's what we're looking at right now, and we can't confirm yet.
And that would be the referendum to remove Blake Frederick as president?
No, actually, what happened with that was right after we announced our results, the day after, we discovered that we had read the Excel spreadsheet wrong and that Blake Frederick was not removed, and that referendum did not even reach quorum. The referendum that did pass, according to our final calculation before this fraud was discovered, was that was the tuition referendum that basically advocated for lower tuition and increased government funding. So that one passed, but it might not have.
And the AMS has hired an independent consultant to review the irregularities, and that independent consultant presented to AMS Council this past Wednesday. Is that correct?
That's not correct. Our auditing process is not finished yet. So we were going to get the FDR, which is Forensic Data Recovery Incorporated, to come in. But since our investigation is not concluded and since they're based in Victoria, we have not brought them in yet. Who we did bring in was the lawyers, and we presented an interim report.
Okay. And is there anything that has come out of that at this point that you can speak about?
You mean since that report came out, or?
It's from the lawyers that have been.
The lawyers are more concerned with what the final decision will be once we have determined all the data that we can from forensic data recovery. So essentially, they can help me decide how I should act once we've received all this information, and whether or not we can just subtract these fraudulent votes and take the results from there, or whether we have to have a re-election. So they help me with that kind of legal advice.
So it doesn't appear at this point, though, that the Office of President and other council other offices will be affected?
They will not be affected. According to the results we calculated, at least the primary ones, the executive and the international student seat are both still standing, though the margins are quite different.
Okay. And let's talk about how this affects AMS elections in the future. Coming out of this, is there reason to believe that maybe doing voting completely online without paper ballots poses problems?
It definitely poses problems, as you can see, but what we have done with the whole forensic data recovery, their audit, is that they've actually discovered all the holes in the system that need to be fixed, and once we fill those, I think that we'll be in good shape for next year. So I don't think it's a major problem.
Okay. And how does this affect, how students feel about voting, about AMS elections? Do you think students are going to lose trust in the system that they have?
It's entirely possible that they will, but it's the job of the elections administrator, both mine and next year's, to ensure that students regain faith in the system. We need to inform students and be transparent about what changes we're making in the system, and ensure that it's as secure as it can possibly be. But I entirely understand that students are a little disillusioned with what's happened.
And a number of recently, Bijan, the new AMS president, expressed concern about this. Do you think there's going to be any pressure from new council members to maybe completely reform the way that voting happens? And if so, how do you feel about that?
I can definitely expect that the council members will have input on what we want to do with the voting system for next year, and I welcome that input as much as we can. There's lots of people with technological expertise, and of course we welcome that. Some changes need to be made, obviously, lots of changes, but once these changes are made, that's great, and I do think it's in the place for council to make these suggestions, since the elections administrator does actually report to council.
And so, looking into the future now, when will we know exactly what's been affected, and how significantly it has different the referendum and other items on the ballot have been affected?
Well, the FDR report should be completed by the end of this week, but the council meeting where we deliver this report isn't going to be at least till the 15th of March, so you won't know till then.
Okay, and up until that point, you won't be able to speak on any matters?
I don't expect I'll be able to.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to CITR.
Yeah, thank you. No worries.
That was Andrew Longhurst in conversation with Isabel Ferreras of AMS Elections. And be sure to tune in to News 101 after March 15th, when we'll be definitely sure to offer you information about what's been happening with this election overhaul. Now we have Denise Dydick in studio from the UBC Storm Club for this week's weather report. And Denise, what can we expect for the weekend?
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the beautiful day. And in fact, I had to be called out of the sunshine to do your weather. We've had a very fair week. Let's see if we'll continue into the weekend. Yep, it seems we're caught in a high-pressure system that has built over Western Canada, bringing clear and warm weather. So here's your weekend forecast for March 5th through 7th. Tonight will be mostly clear with cloudy periods, low of 4 degrees. Saturday will be sunny as well, high of 13 degrees, low of 5. However, showers are expected to sit in by Sunday afternoon as a cold front of a polar maritime air mass pushes through. High of 9, low of 0 degrees. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. Enjoy the lovely weekend. Currently, it's 7 degrees and clear at YVR. For News 101, I'm Denise Diotic.
Well, thank you very much, Denise. We really appreciate that coverage. We're going to take another quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be offering you this week's edition of Groundwire. And that's all on CITR 101.9 News 101.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite. Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Shock! We're losing him! Give me the paddles. We're gonna have to shock him. Clear! Again! Clear! Again! Oh, man!
Local independent print media is in danger of expiring. The Discorder needs your help. Friday, March 5th, CITR hosts a night at the Biltmore to raise funds for Discorder magazine. An all-star lineup of local acts have donated their time to the cause. Performers include Apollo Ghosts, Fine Mist, MT40, Coban, Fanshawe, and Boogie Monster, as well as a special DJ set by the Japandroids and CITR DJs Cam Dales and Tyler Fedchuk. Amidst the entertainment will be prize giveaways and a silent auction with wicked swag. Keep local independent print media alive and kicking. Friday, March 5th at the Biltmore Cabaret, 395 Kingsway in Vancouver.
Welcome back to News 101. This is CITR 101.9, broadcasting live in Vancouver. We're now going to turn to Groundwire, the National and Campus Community Radio Association production of stories from around the country. This week, it's being produced by youth from the Flem City Media Project, CFPK in Toronto's Flemington Park. Today's production focuses stories on the anti-apartheid movement, women in prison, and tuition hikes in Alberta.
We should be outraged that, in fact, we're using the most expensive, least effective system.
Many of these groups have been under severe attack for their alleged anti-Semitism.
When it's the people, it's about the people, you know, like, why don't people have more power?
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news.
I'm Tarun.
I'm Jackie.
And I'm Warda. This week's Groundwire is produced from Flemington Park's Flemo City Media Project, CFPK 92.1 FM in Toronto.
In this week's edition,
Halifax plans for better biking,
Canadian campuses appeal for boycotts against Israel,
and later on, feminists dismiss Canada's official report to the United Nations on the status of women.
For our first headline, we go to the West Coast, where Alberta students aren't sugarcoating their feelings about the latest record-breaking hikes to student fees. Groundwire's Catherine Fisher has more.
The release of the Alberta provincial budget on February 8th saw a freeze to the base operating grants for its post-secondary institutions. The boards of governors of the universities of Alberta and Calgary have both approved the maximum tuition increase for all of their students. Groundwire spoke with Alexandria Eldridge, the Canadian University Press's Alberta Bureau Chief, about these increases and others being proposed by the institutions.
At the U of A, for example, the administration recently approved a $550 non-instructional mandatory fee. They're calling it the Common Student Space and Sustainability Fee. And that is, a $550 fee that's pretty much just going towards helping their deficit. So they're saying that it's going to help keep like the student services available and that kind of thing. They aren't regulated by the government, so that's kind of a hot topic at the U of A right now, because the minister has said that he's not happy about that, but there's nothing he can do about it because that's up to the institution. So the U of A Students Union really wants the government to make some regulation around those types of fees because it's not actually tuition, so the government can't do anything about it at this point.
Several universities in Alberta are also asking Advanced Education Minister Doug Horner to break the tuition regulation and allow increases in professional programs through something called market modifiers.
The University of Calgary, the University of Alberta, and a couple other institutions have submitted proposals for market modifiers to the government. And within a couple of weeks, they'll be hearing back on whether or not those are approved. Those could potentially have tuition increase for up to 47% in some faculties.
Students across the province have been making their feelings about the increases known through a number of actions and protests.
The Alberta Students Executive Council, they had a protest where they handed out fortune cookies. Their protest was called Our Futures, Our Fortunes. And they got students to write handwritten comments for the government about why post-secondary education should be made a priority in the province.
The students then baked the top responses into a giant fortune cookie, which was delivered to Doug Horner, the province's Minister of Advanced Education and Technology. This is Catherine Fisher of CJLY in Nelson reporting for Groundwire. Special thanks to Alexandria Eldridge, the Canadian University Press's Alberta Bureau Chief.
In other student news, Anti-Apartheid Week enters its sixth year on campuses across Canada and the world. Students against Israel apartheid at Carleton University in Ottawa are pushing for a boycott on Carleton's assets linked to Israel. We go to CHRY's Daniel Segay for the details.
Students Against Israeli Apartheid of Carleton University, or SIA Carleton, has recently launched a divestment campaign. It's calling on the Carleton University Pension Fund to discontinue its investment in five companies which have been implicated in human rights violations and crimes under international law in the occupied Palestinian territories. These companies include BAE Systems, L2 Communications, Motorola, Northrop Grumman, and Tesco. Their projects range from the production and development of surveillance systems and arms to the harvest of food on the land of illegal Israeli settlements. In total, the Carleton University Pension Fund's investment in these five companies is about $2.6 million. According to Yafa Jarar of SIA Carleton, the group offers three recommendations.
One of them is that the fund immediately, or the board of governors via the pension fund, immediately divest from these five companies. The other two is refrain from investing in similar companies in the future that violate human rights and international humanitarian law. That may include mining companies, tobacco companies, etc. And the third one is that the pension fund implement and adopt a socially responsible investment policy in a transparent manner with communication with the larger Carleton community.
The student group is optimistic in light of similar and successful campaigns against Carleton administration during South African apartheid. For more information on the divestment campaign, check out carleton.saia.ca. For Groundwire, I'm Daniel Tsagai from CHRY in Toronto.
The Anti-Apartheid Week activities caught the attention of the Ontario Provincial Legislature, which passed a rare unanimous motion denouncing the movement as promoting hate speech. Further to this debate, academic and activist Cynthia Wright recently talked with CHRY's Candice Moores about how measures in Ontario to suppress Anti-Apartheid Week activities threaten academic freedoms and freedom of speech.
My name is Cynthia. I'm an academic, I'm an activist, and I'm a trade unionist. There have been some major attacks on academic freedom in the Canadian context recently. The posters advertising Israeli Apartheid Week have, in the case of I think at least four university administrations, run into considerable difficulty with them either being banned or removed or other kinds of interventions happening.
this is now a much broader issue. It's an off-campus issue in the sense that groups like the Canadian Arab Federation, Rights and Democracy, which is a human rights NGO, Kairos, which as many people know is a kind of alliance, it's a coalition of mainstream Christian groups in the country that does a variety of kind of social justice work. Many of these groups have been under severe attack for their alleged anti-Semitism, by which the federal government seems to mean their criticism of the Israeli state.
We thank Candace Moores in Toronto for that interview.
It's a common sight in bike-friendly cities, and now Halifax wants it too. A proposed bike corridor means safer cycling in the city. Erica Butler brings us the story.
A cycling advocacy group in Halifax is petitioning the city to create an active transportation corridor to connect the north and south ends of the city. Steve Bedard, co-chair of the Halifax Cycling Coalition, says the corridor will link the city's highly residential north end with the businesses, universities, and hospitals in the south end.
The corridor itself would be a connected, continuous bike lane that would connect north and south Halifax, like a practical route that really connects where people live to where they may work, the biggest, you know, economic centers of our city being the hospitals, the defense base in Stadacona, and the universities. So really just connecting that to where people live in a very practical way.
The Halifax Cycling Coalition proposes using current lanes and green spaces to make the corridor project as affordable and achievable as possible. The proposed route avoids any major infrastructure costs, but does include removal of on-street parking in some areas.
What we're proposing is not to totally prohibit cars from biking on this route. It might involve taking away some parking for the installation of bike lanes, but at the same time, there's a great demand on transportation management in Halifax. It's only going to get worse if we don't take steps now to diversify our transportation modes in Halifax. So facilitating biking is one major way, I think, to really bring down the burden that kind of our car culture has on Halifax streets.
For Groundwire, this is Erica Butler from CKDU in Halifax.
Groundwire takes a break now. Here's some music produced here at the Flama City Media Project, a youth radio project where we broadcast live on Wednesdays from the Rec Center. This song is from Elastic, one of Flama City's artists.
Don't even question every time I want her, telling me she love me every time I'm on her. By my side, she by my side. She don't even question every time I want her, telling me she love me every time I'm on her. She by my side, she by my side.
Groundwire is grassroots. If you want to contribute a story, contact us at groundwirepitch@ncra.ca.
Hot spice, you can call me original. Yeah, money tight, but I still spend it. And she sent me house keys like I'm her room tenant. And I don't ever start ish, but I sure end it. And she is stiff to you guys, only I bend it. Sorry, man.
All of our episodes are available for podcasting. Go to groundwire.ncra.ca.
By my side.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is News 101, and you're listening to Groundwire.
National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Groundwire is also listener-supported, so consider donating at www.ncra.ca.
This is a community radio report. This past month, CKDU in Halifax celebrated 25 years of community broadcasting. Gianna Lauren talks with programmers who remember turning the transmitter on.
February 1st, 1985, a station was born.
Happy 25th birthday, CKDU.
Happy birthday, CKDU. I hope it's going to be another amazing 25 years. I'm really excited.
Happy 25th anniversary, CKDU.
CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax, originally 97.5, has been broadcasting from the Dalhousie Student Union Building for 25 years.
For one thing, we had the freedom to program what we wanted to do within, of course, limits of good taste. There was a great freedom and flexibility that attracted me to this work at the station, and we've tried to keep that flavor ever since.
It was a very exciting time. It was new, invigorating, and the community to get behind it.
Probably the original thing that drew me was friends that were involved. And also, we're part of local music, and that's when I started to listen to local music and Canadian music and independent music, and also to hear the music that my friends were playing, and that was music that was like the music my friends were playing, but was from other places.
My name is Felix Kahneman. I'm a programmer here at CKDU.
Well, my name is Steve 2.0, and I've probably been at the station for just over a year now.
My name is Aaron Ashley. I'm the host of Share the Air on Sunday nights. It's a live performance show showcasing local musicians, sometimes musicians from away, and occasionally the local visual artist.
The excitement of the anniversary found volunteers and programmers reflecting on their time at CKDU.
My name is Walter Kemp, and I do a weekly classical and classically related show of music called the Saturday Morning Musical Box. We've been going since the first weekend of CKDU.
I'm Lucas Danbergs. I've been a programmer at CKDU for about 7 years, but I've been involved for more like 16 or 17.
Okay.
I'm Bev Lamb, and I've hosted a show called Touchstone, which is a folk music program on CKDU, and I've done it for nearly 25 years.
CKDU developed a strong presence in the community.
When I was younger and in high school, I listened to a lot of community radio. There's a lot of programming that, you know, I just wouldn't have been exposed to otherwise.
Campus community radio is no longer the alternative. It is the core listening for a very significant number of people in Canada.
It speaks to the quality and diversity and creativity.
The past 25 years has us thinking about the next 25.
Campus and community radio right now kind of has like a huge chance to step up and take on a bigger role in radio, because what we're seeing right now in the music industry is there's a lot of indie artists out there, and it's a lot easier for them to get their music out there, especially through campus community radio stations.
Technology is actually building and helping radio expand even further.
It's really tough right now, you know, just sort of bringing the community in and having them actually care about community radio.
Radio isn't dying. It's evolving, much like the music industry is right now, but it's certainly not dying.
The normal sort of radio which you can pick up with an antenna, I think it won't die because it's always present in everybody's life.
Well, it's a wonderful vehicle for learning. There's a knack that comes with time and feeling easy when you do that. So it's a wonderful training ground. You can learn by just doing, so don't feel you have to know a lot about radio to get into here in the first place.
You can just step in and just start helping out, doing little things, and then it sort of snowballs.
If we really got our names out there, then we could go far.
Thank goodness.
It's pretty a little sigh of relief there.
Walter Kemp, do you miss sleeping in on Saturday morning?
Not at all. Whatever was going on, at the end of the week I knew I could get up Saturday morning and have an oasis of creativity, or chat with friends, or play some music.
Happy anniversary, CKDU. Let's hear it for another 25 more. For Groundwire, this is Gianna Lauren reporting from Halifax.
Hey Tarun, that could be CFPK in 25 years, eh?
Probably. This week, Groundwire comes to you from CFPK, the Fleming City Media Project for Youth in Toronto's Flemington Park. We started up just about 3 years ago.
Our first feature this week comes from Edmonton, where the energy crunch is tightening. Renewable energy is on everyone's agenda, including the for-profit energy businesses. An unsettling high percentage of our nationally produced energy is exported to other nations for big cash. Environmentalists are urging Canadians to adopt a new framework for new energy. This one is not for profit. Jay Gregg has a story.
Today I'd like to start on a critical foot and pose the timely question. Why do we Canadians not demand to have more public ownership of the energy resources within our borders? According to Richard Heinberg of the Post Carbon Institute, we are already late in preparing for the necessary transition and investment to renewable energy. About 30 University of Alberta students traveled north from Edmonton to Fort McMurray for the first oil sands delegation. This opportunity spurred my interest in long-term energy sustainability, and not just that new buzzword sustainability either. Unfortunately, the landmass of the boreal forest, slated to be fragmented and destroyed for oil sands extraction, is astonishingly larger than the state of Florida.
I don't want to talk about the things that scare you now.
Day one of the oil sands delegation included a presentation from Suncor and a bus tour of select Syncrude leases, information centers, and displays. Day two consisted of a presentation at the Oil Sands Discovery Center and a stakeholder panel discussion held by the United Way at the Red Pole Center. The following clip is from that stakeholder panel discussion. The Female Voices Greenpeace campaigner, Melina Labucan-Masima of the Lubicon Cree First Nation, and the male voice is Martin O'Brien Kelly, stakeholder relations representative of Suncor.
What we really need for people as a whole and like and the communities that are being impacted is that we really do need to have a stronger voice in asking for this renewable energy economy that needs to be happening now. For me, like what I'd love to do in the future is get more investment to put that into First Nation communities. Like, why is it always First Nation communities that are on the front lines that have to deal with toxic contamination? You know, why can't we have our own solar energy in our communities, and like why can't that feed onto the grid? So it's like all these different things and solutions that do exist, but they're not being implemented here, so industry can keep doing what they're doing, essentially.
Suncor really does have a plan to go to renewable energy. They own 5 wind farms, and they own and run Canada's largest ethanol plant. But, you know, I don't think we're quite there in terms of, you know, some people say, let's get rid of oil and gas, tomorrow and get on renewable. And it's like, realistically, we're not there yet, you know?
But that's the problematic thing is, though, because we're not getting that investment that's needed. So you know what I mean? So the money is going to the oil and gas industry instead of going to, like, people's future in the renewable energy.
Yeah.
You need to have that sector even exist here.
Right, but I think you do need the private sector to take it on. And, yes, the government, instead of, you know, the government giving tax breaks to oil and gas companies.
They're giving billions of dollars.
They could, you know, they could really encourage investment in renewable energy. So, you know, Suncor does have that, and that makes sense, you know. Fossil fuels won't be around forever, and you have to make that transition somehow.
But why is it always that companies and corporations have to own that energy? Why can't it be people, communities that own energy, that live off of that energy? Why can't we own our own energy? And that's, I think, the paradigm shift that needs to happen. You know, like always giving, like we're people that grew up, like we're babies under corporations. Like as if they're like this third branch of government. And when it's the people, it's about the people, you know, like why don't people have more power in this province?
Well, I think that's consumerism, you know?
For sure. But it's the power that's given to corporations.
Which I guess we all give through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you have it. It seems as Canadians, we are all in need of a stronger voice in the inevitable transition to renewable energy. Ethanol was mentioned, but ethanol is primarily produced through corn and other food crops. This is particularly frightening, considering there is already a food distribution problem resulting in famine across the globe. The feed and tariff system that Melina mentioned involves guaranteed grid access, long-term contracts for the electricity produced, and purchase prices which are methodologically based on the cost of renewable energy generation. So why has the Alberta government not tapped into this technology? Why do our governments entrust such important social necessities such as energy to the private sector when it's clearly the responsibility of the public sector? The leaders of the world, through the World Economic Forum, have been ruffling some capitalist feathers with a lot of talk of post-free market economies where more government regulation is required because our economy is just too important to be left to market forces. Jade Gregg signing off for CJSR and Groundwire.
When the trucks stop pulling in, will you remember how to grow your own food? When the trucks stop, when the trucks stop, stop, stop. And I don't want to have to be the one to scare you, but things are looking just a little grim. I don't want to have to be the one to scare you. We weren't doing much of anything.
March 8th is International Women's Day, but Canadian women are not celebrating. Instead, feminists and labor groups say the government's rosy reports of the United Nations World Conference on Women this week needs a reality check. In just 5 years, Canada has fallen from a top 10 ranking in women's human rights to a startling 73rd in the UN Gender Disparity Index.
Next, Britt Ray examines the lack of rights and resources for women in Canada's prison system.
In 1934, the first female prisoners moved from Kingston Penitentiary, a few minutes away, to the all-new P4W. Prison for women.
And the thing about being in prison, there is so much injustice that goes on. Like, that's the thing that's the most, that shocks a person when you've never been in jail before. And you get into the system, and you're so inundated with injustice that it's numbing on one level, but it's overwhelming, you know, like, where to start?
P4W lasted for 66 years as Canada's only federal incarceration facility for women, and it functioned on all three levels, minimum, medium, and maximum security. It was a grim place. In the Canadian Federation of Elizabeth Fry Societies, an organization that works with women and girls in the justice system, vied for its closing for several years, which finally happened in 2000 when it sold its property to Queen's University. To replace it, the government ended up funding the construction of five new regional prisons, which were built across several provinces. And although the motivation of the change was to improve the living conditions of the prisoners, it seems like the only change accomplished has been cosmetic. I was given reason to believe this from Anne Hansen. She's a woman who spent a considerable amount of time in P4W, as well as some in a new regional prison.
Even though these new prisons were intended, they came out of the Louise Arbour Commission and supposedly were supposed to provide more programming, more educational opportunities, more vocational training, allow the women to live closer to their families. Bye. None of those things have actually materialized. And so the prisons, if you go there or you see a little video about them, architecturally they look way better than the prison for women, because the prison for women looked like sort of a Hollywood stereotypical prison from the 1800s, you know. In reality, once, like, I was actually in prison again for the summer in 2006, so I was actually in Grand Valley at that time, so I got to sort of experience firsthand what it was like. Although it looked quite nice, and perhaps for the first day, it seems like, you know, you've walked into a dream world in some way. It's actually not an improvement over P4W. I mean, there is very little in terms of what you can do there on a day-to-day level. But the amount of food money that's allocated is so low that they really, really have a difficult time getting enough sort of food to prepare decent meals. You know, there's no job training, there's no trades that you can learn. When I was there in 2006, the beauty parlor, which in prison for women was another job that was available to learn hairdressing, but it was closed in Grand Valley. Even the one room they had for a school, which was called the school, it was really just one room, was closing in the fall of all times. They didn't have a teacher. When I was there, which was in the 80s and a little bit in the early 90s there had been implemented some programs, I think, from the efforts of, you know, the women's movement and sort of the liberalizing effect of the 60s and early 70s, you know. Because, for example, in P4W, for a while, they were taking women over to Collins Bay to train in auto mechanics. But we had a full-scale woodworking shop where I spent most of my time when I was in prison. Whereas in the new regional prisons, they don't have anything like that, wood shops or, you know, any kinds of training in the trades. To my knowledge, they were just finishing a building that they had, were working on called for CORCAN, which is the Correctional sort of the Correctional Services of Canada employment arm. But what the women were going to be doing when it was completed was sewing men's underwear for the men's prison. So, you know, things have not improved.
Well, that left me wondering, what are the women who are in the regional prisons now going to do when they get back out into society?
That's very important because so many women in prison have no way of making a living when they get out, because the statistics are 50% of the women in prison have grade 9 or lower education, and 40% are illiterate. You know, 80%, this is just 80% has been the statistics for decades, is the overall percentage of women who've been sexually or physically abused. So for women to break out of that cycle of having to go out and either turn tricks or sell drugs or commit fraud, they need to be able to have some skills to get a job.
So what is your ideal job?
And a lot of women do need a little bit of help with the sexual and physical abuse histories that they have, you know? Now, these sort of things you'd think would be rudimentary, but no, they don't exist.
Female prisoner populations have been on the rise since the closing of P4W. In the 5 years following its closure, the Canadian female prison population went up by 30%. Women who are racialized, poor, and suffering from mental health issues are the fastest growing in-prison population across the world. I talked to Kim Pate, the executive director of the Elizabeth Fry Societies.
In the 60s and 70s, women were vastly, and still are, vastly overrepresented in psychiatric inpatient and outpatient facilities. We used to see fewer women criminalized because they were more likely to be housed in psychiatric hospitals and institutions. But with the deficit dementia that swept the nation over the past couple of decades, the support services that were set up in the communities were cut. And so what we saw is literally more and more people being dumped into the streets, particularly women and kids with mental health issues, men too. And so, you know, I remember visiting Newfoundland, having the fellow who was in charge of the jail, you know, I commented that I had just heard on the news that they were closing another wing of the local psychiatric hospital. And he said, yes, you know, I can't do a Newfoundland accent at all, but my dear, they may as well take a truck over there, load those women up and back it up here, because this is where they're coming.
Women with mental health issues are only one group who are overrepresented in the prisons. Statistics show that Aboriginal women make up 30% of the federal prison population, but only 2.8% of the Canadian population. And in the case of Saskatchewan, 87% of their female prisoners are Aboriginal. Stuart Mayo is a member of the Mohawk Traditional Council at Ganawage, and he talked to me a little bit about this.
As you mentioned, the amount of Native women that are represented in the Canadian jailing system. We know that that is systemic also from the residential school policy. You know, that as the residential school policy attacked children, that meant that it had devastating effects on the mothers of those children. So if that female entity can be affected in a negative way, then all the offspring after that will be affected in a negative way also, which is a direct effect, direct cause as to why there is so many Native women in the Canadian prison system.
A demonstrator at the 2008 Walk for Justice mentioned another harsh reality.
Knowing that within those walls, you know, how many of our sisters, our dear loved ones, you know, have, you know, fallen prey to the violence in there. On our way around there, you know, to the yard, I found like a 9mm. It was a small shell. You know, that horrified us. You know, that we will never know, you know, what's going on behind those walls. But, you know, we would like to honor them, you know, and remember them.
Imprisonment.
It causes women to become, you know, more self-abusive because they have no way of getting out of there. So, you know, women slash or try to hang themselves or take hostages, you know, and then get into worse and worse trouble.
You know, and we should be outraged that, in fact, we're using the most expensive, least effective, quote-unquote, system.
That report, courtesy of Britt Ray and Citizen Shift.
That's all for this edition of Groundwire.
Thanks for listening.
I'm Warda.
And I'm Tarun. And special thanks to Flemish City's Aisha Rowe, Robert, and Mikey.
Groundwire. National news, not for profit.
CJSF 90.1.
Ottawa.
From Vancouver.
Reporting from Montreal.
From Winnipeg.
And Abbotsford.
CJSW has the story.
CHRY in Toronto.
CFRC Radio.
CJSF.
Get grassroots voices and community news from coast to coast to coast.
You can hear Groundwire bi-weekly on your local community radio station. Download the program at ncra.ca. Just click on the Groundwire link.
Groundwire is a project of the National Campus Community Radio Association.
All right, everyone, that was Groundwire, and that marks the end of our show for March 5th, 2010. We're proud that today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to get involved with our program, we'd love to have you. You can friend us and follow us on Facebook and Twitter with the username CITR News. Otherwise, drop us a line at news@citr.ca or give us a shout at 604-822-5334. Andrew Longhurst produced this radio program. For more news, join us this Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Brad Pepping. For the entire news team here at CITR, thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned for Hot Mess right here on 101.9 FM CITR. Here I am, here you are.